Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, Part 3, The Perfection of Nekomya, The Heart of Renunciation, with Jack Kornfield.
The third of these qualities, these ancient teachings that still speak to us directly, is a quality in Pali or Sanskrit called nekamma, which means renunciation. It's a difficult quality. It's hard to understand it in a society that teaches that accumulation is happiness, isn't it? And there are all these ancient images of yogis in caves eating nothing but nettle soup and stuff like that. Yet somewhere in us we know about simplicity. Maybe it's when you go camping up in the mountains, in the Sierras or in the forest somewhere, and you live out for a few days or a week or longer just under the trees with a tent and a camping fire, and how good it feels to live in that way so simply. How much joy there is. As usual, as we talked about in these past weeks, there are a series of children's stories, or they're called the Jataka tales, that illustrate in some way these qualities that we might understand in ourselves. One of the Jataka tales that relates to this quality of nekamma is the Jataka tale of Prince Vasantara. And I would call it the tale of the prince's dilemma. You see, he was born a long, long time ago, when you were much younger as well, in an ancient kingdom in India, near Varanasi. And his father was a great king. And he was born as the first son, the crown prince, to be given the kingdom. He looked around at how it was to be king, since that was going to be his station. I don't know if you've ever encountered a king, but living in the kingdom of Thailand, as I did for a long time, or the kingdom of Siam, where the king is a very beloved figure and a very benevolent king, and watching him at certain ceremonies or on TV or the different ways that one knows about the king or people who spent time with him and so forth. The poor king. He's in palaces and riches and all of that. To be a king in some ways is also to be a prisoner. You can't go anywhere without the guards and the security and all the people making a fuss and everybody bowing. And you know what it must be like to be in this country, the president or vice president or head of some other part of the government. All the kind of security and all the ways in which your life is no longer your own. So the prince began to look at that, wonder whether that was the job that he wanted. And he grew up learning all the princely arts, and he had everything that was supposed to make him happy. A lot of us have that too, you know. I mean, not everything. I know you can imagine more bigger houses and fancier cars and more money in the bank account and so forth, but if you really look at what's supposed to make you happy? A warm, beautiful home, some chariot or thing that gets you around that starts in the morning, basically, right, and works for you. You know, enough food and so forth. We have what the prince had, all the things that were supposed to make him happy. And then he looked around and he realized this truth, that they don't necessarily make you happy. It's not that there's something wrong with them. They're fine. It's fine to have them. But you know people who have them, who are happy, and people who have all these things the prince had, who are unhappy, depressed, frightened, sorrowful in so many ways. And then the prince began to consider what made him happy. He was married, had a family, wife, two children. And he saw what made him happy was giving things away. So he started to give all the things that he had away. That's what made him happy, being generous, caring for other people. And he gave all the riches that were the prince's riches to give away. until there was almost nothing else. And then his brothers were upset with him for doing that and vying for the throne. He said, fine, you can have it. His father said, really? He said, yes, I give it to the other princes. The princes were still jealous. If you're around, we can't have it. He said, fine, I will go. I'll go live simply in the forest. And he left with his wife and his children to go in the forest, having given all that away. And the gods look down and they say, something bizarre is going down here. Somebody's actually behaving themselves in a noble way. We better take a closer look. And the gods decided to test him, as they do in these stories. So one of the gods came down and made himself appear as an old Brahmin farmer. And as the prince and his wife were entering the forest to live there simply, and someone said, there's wild animals. And the prince said, oh no, the forest is filled with beautiful creatures and beautiful trees and beautiful flowers. He had a different vision of nature. And this old man came and he said, I'm a poor Brahmin farmer and I can't till my land. I'm old and frail and I have so many things that need to be done. And would you mind, could I have your children to help me? And this, you know how these stories are kind of extreme. The prince said, I see that you need help. Take my son and daughter with you, and they will care for you. This was really the god come down in that form. So there he was alone with his wife and the forest, the two of them, having given away everything, as happens in the end of these stories. At some point, it seemed that there was danger in the forest, wild animals that came in that area. And then the forest became filled with light. And the old Brahmin came back leading the two children and turned into this great radiant being and said, I will protect you as long as you choose to live here and protect you when you go home, for I see that you have indeed a truly great heart. And eventually he went back and helped in the kingdom, and so the story had a happy ending. Now, if one listens to such a story, it's a great extreme, giving everything away, renouncing everything, even one's own children. You know, I mean, is that necessary for liberation? There are certain moments, for those of you who are parents who really understand that you're giving away your children. Come on now, you know those moments, right? But I think if you look at it in a mythological way, that it speaks about returning to the child of the spirit in us, that all those other things didn't satisfy the heart. What is this awakening of this quality of renunciation? We are Buddhas, and we are householders, so we're not going to go live in caves. What can such a story mean to us? Is it still valid? I like the fact that the gods appear and turn into light at the end, which means that it's not meant to be taken literally. It's a symbolic thing to understand, a symbolic level. And that it doesn't mean that you give away your children, but that your heart releases something to find a new and brighter kind of freedom. The renunciation of the heart means not possessing, not owning, not attaching, not worrying. It's simple. The extent of our attachment, the extent of our wanting, the extent of our fear of losing clouds the mind, closes the heart, creates our suffering. It's like a little light on the dashboard. If there's, you know, suffering in your life, it's like those little idiot lights that light up. What are you attached to? Not pain. Pain comes and goes. But the conflict of suffering. Now in the Bible it says also, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the gates of heaven. I read that last year from a biblical scholar that the eye of a needle was actually the name for a very small stone gate in the wall in Jerusalem. that a person could walk through, but not carrying a basket or bundles, and certainly not a camel. This side is the rock, that side's the hard place, right? And you can just barely fit through. The extent of our attachment, our wanting, our fear of loss, is the extent of our suffering. And renunciation speaks about the joy of letting go, not of poverty, but of trust and abundance. There's this old Zen saying that goes, "How refreshing, the whinny of a pack horse unloaded of everything." Can you feel that? Putting things down, letting go of them? There's a blessed quality to this renunciation. Here's Peter Matheson. He writes, "Soon the child's clear eye is clouded over by ideas, ambition, preoccupations, opinions. Simple, free being becomes encrusted year by year, the armor of the ego. Not until years later does an instinct come that a vital sense of mystery has been withdrawn. The sun glints through the pines, and the heart is pierced in a moment of beauty and strange pain, like a memory of paradise. And after that day, we become again seekers." There's a remembering in us of what really makes us happy, and it's not the stuff. So what is this renunciation? The first is the renunciation on the physical level, the renunciation of stuff. You know the joy of clearing out your attic or your closets or your garage, giving away all that stuff that accumulates. It's amazing. I mean, there you are and it builds up. How good it feels to let some of it go. There's a story of Mullah Nasruddin about this. It seems that there was a tax collector coming through the villages in the Middle East, Sufi wise man and fool. And this tax collector came through the village during the rainy season. The stream was high, and as he walked along by the edge of the stream, he fell in and yelled, "Help, help," and almost drowning in the water, and then held on to a rock a little ways from the shore to keep from being carried away. And all the villagers clustered around and they said, "You know, give me your hand," reaching out to him, "give me your hand and we'll bring you to safety." And the man just clung to the rock and wouldn't stick his arm out, and the water was too fast for them to go into it. And Nasruddin walked up to the crowd and said, "What's wrong?" And they said, "Oh, the tax collector's fallen in the river. We're trying to get him out. You know, he won't let go of the rock." And he went up and he listened. Everyone was saying, "Give me your hand." And he wouldn't listen. And Nasruddin looked at him and he said, "Here, take my hand." And immediately the tax collector took it. And he grabbed him and pulled him to the shore safely. And he turned around and said, "Never ask the tax collector to give you anything." Now, Joseph Goldstein, who is a dear friend and colleague for many years in teaching Vipassana, lived for a long time in India. He did his training in Bodh Gaya, in the village where the tree of the Buddha's enlightenment is in India. And at one point, as he was living in this Burmese monastery there, he invited his mother Evelyn to come and visit him, because he spent a lot of years in Asia and he wanted her to meet his teacher and see what he was doing. And she was somewhat adventurous that time, and so she went to India. She was probably 60 or something like that at that time. And they got her a nice hut in the monastery, kind of the nicest, which meant cement floor. It had a window which made it nice. It was probably, you know, 6 by 6 or 6 by 8, something like that. There was one wooden bed, which she put a kind of thin a mat on for her, and a chair. So it was kind of luxurious for the monastery. And at first she walked in and thought she would die. How am I supposed to live in this, right? But she spent a month there. Joseph took her to his teacher, who was this very kind and humorous and delightful man, Manindra. who spent a lot of time with her, and he taught her to meditate, and she took walks and pilgrimage and so forth. And she had her suitcase in her little hut and the few things in medicine that she needed, and they went out and they ate either in the monastery where there were meals or in the bazaar and a couple of the little kind of food stalls. And by the end of her month there, she said that it was one of the happiest months of her whole life. And she said, I couldn't have believed it when I saw that room. There was nothing in it. And it was so happy to be there. The happiness that comes not from what we have, but how we are, what is in our being. Dwayne Elgin, who was sat in retreats and many years ago, wrote a very compelling book for our time entitled Voluntary Simplicity. Not the simplicity because you're supposed to be good or you have too much and you have to give it to somebody who has less. There are those kinds of thoughts. But the simplicity for the pleasure of it. In Thailand, we lived in this little fishing village in two huts on the beach. One was where we slept. And our kind of our bed and things like that was pretty small. And then the hut next to it on the beach was where we did our painting and writing and played and things like that. And it was just glorious. No furniture, no phone, no fax, no email, no car. We walked everywhere. I mean, I could get nostalgic talking about it, and you'll get jealous, I think, you know. And already I'm back in the thick of everything, and I think, oh, that was such a sane way to live, so simply. In the monastery, in the tradition of monastic renunciation, a monk or a nun is supposed to be content with only four things. And there's a chant every day as a blessing, thank you for this, for food that's offered. One meal a day, here's the food you need. It's given to you. You don't have to worry about it or prepare it. It's just placed in your bowl. Cloth. Cloth is offered and it's made into a simple robe. Should I wear the green robe, the red robe with fringes today? You just have a robe. You put it on. No thought about it. It's like doing your hair. Should I do my hair? Don't have to bother. You know? I don't either much anymore, but anyway. Shelter. Food, clothing, shelter. A little hut. Place at the base of a tree. Some very simple dwelling. And then medicine, if you're sick, if your body needs it, it's provided. And every day you do a series of reflections that I'm given the basics that care for this body, food, clothing, shelter, medicine. Let the riches come now from my heart. So simple. And what you find is that it's not poverty. So when I speak about stuff, it asks us to look at our lives. What should we let go of? And the letting go may be the literal letting go, or it may be the letting go inwardly. And what should we care for without grasping, but with respect? What has been entrusted in our care? Because in the end, you know, you're just the accountants in the firm. You kind of get to care for it, but you don't get to keep it, do you? You're the steward of the stuff. But then what happens? You die and the stuff passes to somebody else. It's just how it is. It's not yours. It's just there for a time. And just as it's personal, it is also universal. As a society, we have to think about it. This is Dwight Eisenhower. Every gun that is made, every warship that is launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. This world in armaments is not spending its money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the clouds of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. What has been entrusted to us, and what do we do with it? When you go in New Delhi in India, outside there is the memorial to Mahatma Gandhi, these great green lawns that lead down to the banks of the Ganges River. And on one of the great stone slabs at the end, very simple, just carved in some of the words of Gandhi, is this phrase that says, "Before you act, think of the poorest person you have met and consider if your next act will have any benefit to them." This is Gandhi's gift to the world, that kind of consideration. It's simple. Where we possess and own in an unhealthy way, we worry, we're caught, and we're neither at peace nor free. And since it all changes, it's guaranteed that it's going to change, and you're going to lose it anyway, we need to discover a capacity to let go, a graciousness of heart as things come and go, to find the real source of happiness. So one kind of renunciation is the renunciation of stuff and how we grasp it and accumulate it and what we do with it. The second is the renunciation of the possession of others. People don't like to be possessed, and in the end they can't be. To the extent that we try to possess or control our spouse, our lovers, our parents, our children, to that extent will we suffer. There's fear, sorrow, and all of those states that come. In the end, all we can do is love them. Look at your relationships to those around you, even to your children. If you try and control them and make them be a certain way and possess them, what happens? First, a lot of struggle. They get away anyway, eventually. Tremendous kind of suffering. There reaches a certain point where all you can do as they get older is give them your blessings and pray. Like when they get their driver's license for the first time and go out and take the car. What can you do? It's time for prayer. Ursula Le Guin, she writes, "It is a wonderful and terrible thing, this kindness that human beings find. Terrible because when we are finally naked in the dark and cold, it is all we have. And wondrous, for we who are so rich and so full of strength wind up with that. That is truly what we have to give." You'll notice that we mistakenly try to possess others in two ways, through grasping and through aversion, through its opposite. Grasping, my wife, my husband, my lover, my daughter, my son, my father. I want them to be this way. They should stay the same. They shouldn't leave. They shouldn't change. And to the extent that there is that demand, there's conflict. I had a woman come to me one day with a family, several children, and she said it was just too much for her, and she wanted to go into a monastery and really learn surrender. That's what she said to me. And I said, "You have your monastery, and I can't think of a better place to learn surrender than at home with your spouse and your job and your children and so forth." It's important to understand that renunciation or letting go does not mean a lack of commitment. You're committed in your work, in your relationship with your children or those you care about. But the commitment is to stay present, to care for, to honor, to love, but not to possess or control. It's a commitment of love. Can you hear the difference? And in renunciation, you let go of the possession and you care for what's there, a stewardship. There's a tremendous power in it. But on the other side, we get caught so easily. I remember a friend of mine whose relationship ended in a very sad way some years ago, the man that she was living with and loved got involved with another woman, had an affair, left her, and she was devastated by it. And we were together in a Zen retreat, and she told the Zen master all about this and so forth, and he was very solicitous and said, well, you have to grieve and experience all this and make it part of your Zen. And she did. He came back a year later, and he was traveling. We had another retreat. She was there. He said, how are you? She said, oh, I'm still so sad. He said, what happened? She said, well, he's still gone. I've never heard from him. And I just, you could tell she was just going over and over this loss in many, many ways, and still just stuck with it. And he said, oh, I have a gift for you. I brought you a special gift. And he reached into his Zen master's bag and he took out this mala, a set of beautiful beads that had little Buddhas carved in them. He said, I have a gift for you. And he put it in her hands and he said, here, take it in your two hands. This is a gift to help you. And he held her two hands in one hand like this, and then he looked her in the eye. And he reached back and he slapped her across the face and he yelled at her, let him go! And then dropped his hands and looked at her. I was just dumbstruck. Is this abuse or what? You know? But it had been a year and he told her a year. And he said, enough already. Enough already. And you know what? She changed. In a moment, it's like, okay, I get the message. It's a little extreme again. But you know how much suffering comes from trying to possess other people, don't you? That's what this story talks about. Or we can possess them by the opposite, by resistance and anger. See how to explain this. There's a saying, a philosopher is wedded to their opponent. Do you understand? That you can be wedded to someone through conflict as well. And so the renunciation of the possession of others is a renunciation of judgment, of anger, of grudges. Even if you have a good reason to carry a grudge, right? It's the renunciation anyway. It's the letting go of the pain of carrying it. Just, let me let that go. The breath. Always I thought you alone were to blame. This last instant my eyes open and I regard you with all the tenderness and love I've withheld for so long. It's not carrying that grudge and judgment and anger for the injustices of the world. Doesn't mean you can't protect yourself or care for yourself, but to not carry that either. The Buddha says, look how he abused me, he beat me, threw me down, robbed me. Perpetuate these thoughts and you live in hate. Look how he abused me, beat me, threw me down, robbed me. Abandon such thoughts and live in loving kindness. In this world, hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and universal law. You too shall pass away, knowing this. How long can you quarrel? So the Dalai Lama, who is the most extraordinary figure in the face of the sufferings of Tibetan people, says, if you can't be happy, what is the use of this life? Talks about the Chinese army, my friend's the enemy. There's a spirit of nobility in renunciation that's there in that first story. And I heard, when I was traveling in Bali, a tale that I think fits into this talk. Let's see. I want to tell it to you because it was very moving when I heard it. And that is, a long time ago in Bali, at the beginning of this century, the island of Bali was the last remaining free area in what is now Indonesia, but at that time was the Dutch East Indies. And the Netherlands, like all the colonial powers, the British and Spanish and so forth, had sent gunboats out to Asia and taken over different countries and made their empires. The British Empire had India and Burma and so forth, and the Dutch gunboats took over what is now Indonesia, or big parts of it, but not Bali. So this island was not colonized until 1906, I believe. And so what happened is that a ship of the Dutch East Indies Flag Company found her on the rocks outside of the harbor at Denpasar in Bali and split open. And the people escaped as best they could. And then the villagers and those who lived along the coast went out in their boats and took all the stuff from the ship, as one does, kind of salvage from a ship that was wrecked. Well, the Dutch East Indies Company and the Dutch government together decided that they wanted a redress of all that was stolen, and they demanded of the rajas, of the kings or princes of Bali, that it be paid back fivefold or tenfold, something like that. And it was an outrageous thing that was asked, and the kings or the rajas would not do it. And so they sent several gunboats to Bali with cannon and rifles and all those kinds of things. And the Balinese had swords and daggers. And they came. They came to the islands, dropped anchor, and deployed a whole company of soldiers with their weapons. And they said, "We've come because you didn't pay. We're taking the country over," and so forth. And the rajas of Bali knew that they had no weapons to match them. What they did is they called the whole court together, all the princes and princesses, the wives and children, and they said, "We must defend ourselves." And they then addressed in their finest silks, the most beautiful brocades and the most exquisite batiks, and they really know how to dress in Bali, I'll tell you, put flowers, gold, all their jewelry on, and they took the wealth of the treasury with them in containers, in silver and gold containers. They got on their most magnificent horses. They took their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers' swords and daggers, and all of them went out in full battle array with the entire court to meet the Dutch who came. And when the Dutch were coming forward, the soldiers, they said, "You will not take this island without a sacrifice." And first they charged at the Dutch, and the Dutch didn't want to shoot at them because they were so beautiful to see, amazing. But they kept charging, so they began to shoot at them. And as soon as the Dutch opened fire, then all of the women and the children of the courts began throwing jewels and gold and the money from the treasury at them, saying, "Go away, here is our wealth." And then they took the daggers and they stabbed themselves, and 3,000 people killed themselves. And there was this huge heap of bodies, some shot by the Dutch, but most of them having committed suicide themselves. So that was the story. And first I heard it and I was kind of shocked, because it's kind of stunning and shocking story. And I thought, well, I can imagine their need to protect the island, but didn't really do any good. You know, they became a colony thereafter. And then I heard the last part of the story. You see, Bali is the only place in that archipelago that really was untouched by colonialization and missionaries and so forth, because the story got back to Europe, to the king and queen of the Netherlands and to the other capitals of Europe, of this image of the royalty throwing gold and jewels and killing themselves in this pile of bodies. And the Dutch military was shamed by it. So deeply shamed that there was an outcry throughout Europe in 1906 that you cannot do this to another culture. And so there was a pact made, yes, it would become part of the Dutch East Indies, but no missionaries could be sent to convert the Balinese. No one was allowed to go and tamper with their culture, their dance, their art, their music, their sacred theater. And they were to give a certain amount of their produce as a colony, and the rest they were to be left alone. And so the last part of the story is that actually the Rajas succeeded, because you can go to Bali today and all that was beautiful there is still there because of their sacrifice. And yet at first it wouldn't have seemed that way. There is a beauty to renunciation. And the deepest level of renunciation, there's the renunciation of things, the renunciation of the possession of others, is the renunciation of fear itself, the discovery of the fearless heart. Fear is a story we tell to ourselves. If you look at what fear really is, it's always a thought about what's going to happen. We're never afraid of what's here. We're always afraid of what's coming next. It's true, isn't it? I mean, even if you're hiking in the mountains and a bear is chasing you, you're not afraid of the bear chasing you. You're afraid of what happens when it gets you, right? And even when the bear grabs you, you're not afraid of being grabbed by the bear. That just hurts and you hate it. It's terribly painful. That's not scary. You're afraid of what the bear's going to do next, right? Isn't it so? It's always what's going to happen next that we're afraid of. And when we live in those thoughts, we live in contraction, in what is called the body of fear. Our ambition, our hopes, our fear of pain and loss and suffering. Who has avoided suffering in this room or pain? Raise your hand. It's part of our life. So there's all these fears that somehow if we do it right, if we hold on, if we could make it right, there wouldn't be loss, there wouldn't be death, there wouldn't be change, there wouldn't be praise and blame and joy and sorrow and light and dark, but there is every day. When we live in the body of fear, there isn't a happiness of heart. So the deepest renunciation is letting go of fear itself and to live in a place of trust in our being. We have to distinguish renunciation from a kind of inner impoverishment that comes because so many of us are wounded, or from a meaninglessness. It doesn't mean that you should live without some sense of riches or meaning, but it's simply that stuff doesn't do it. Possession doesn't do it. Kabir, the Indian mystic poet, even in our fear, we sense that there is some sort of spirit that loves birds and animals and ants. Perhaps the same that gave a radiance to you in your mother's womb. Is it logical you would be walking around entirely orphaned now? The truth is you turned away yourself and decided to go into the dark alone. Now you're tangled up in others and have forgotten what your heart once knew. And that's why everything you do can have difficulty, failure. Kabir says, who are you really, wanderer? Why not remember today? I believe a blade of grass is the journey work of the stars, says Walt Whitman, that we have riches all around us, in the sunlight and the moonlight, in the air we breathe, in the eyes of the people that sit next to us. It's really so amazing. And it's there in its own right, as we are here in our own right. There's some sense that we don't belong when we're struggling and trying to get. We have to get more and then we'll find our place. You belong here. This is your place. You were born on this place to breathe, to see, to hear, to listen, to awaken. Thomas Merton writes, he says, there is a mercy of each being in themselves and each thing far beyond their name, in their own right, without reason. They are virtuous in their own right, and their names do not identify them. Every plant that stands in the light of the sun is a saint and an outlaw. Every tree that brings forth blossoms without the command of human beings is powerful in the sight of the divine. Every star that we have not counted is a world of sanity and perfection. Every blade of grass is an angel singing in a shower of glory. To understand renunciation is to step outside of time. All the things we plan and hope and worry and fear about, it's okay to take care of time sometimes. But it's really important to take a rest and to step into that which is timeless, to find a place of belonging. I have a very strong sense from meditations and experiences I've had and sitting with others as they've died, various things, that when it comes to the end, when you die, you will kind of look back and say, wow, that was an amazing one, wasn't it? That life. That was an amazing life, just as it was. And if you look at all those things like Life After Life, Raymond Moody's book, the near-death experiences, and people talk about these beings of light that appear to them, you know, in all kinds of guises, and ask them these simple questions. Is it worth it? Was the way you lived really the way you wanted to live? Are you ready to let go now? The kind of questions the being of light asked. I knew I was dying and there was nothing I could do about it because no one could hear me. I floated out of my body. There's no doubt I could see my own body on the operating room table. My soul was free. All this made me feel very bad at first, but then this really bright light appeared. It did seem that it was a little dim at first, but then it was this huge beam. Too much light. It gave off heat, warmth. It filled the room. Bright, yellowish, white, tremendous. I can't describe it. It seemed it covered everything, yet it didn't prevent me from seeing the doctors, the nurses. I could see clearly. It wasn't blinding. And at first, when the light came, I wasn't sure what was happening. But then it kind of asked. It asked me if I was ready. It was like talking to a person, but a person wasn't there. The light was talking to me in a voice I could hear. Now I think that voice was talking to me. I actually realized that I wasn't ready to die yet. You know, it was just kind of testing me more than anything. Yet from the moment that the light appeared, I felt so good, secure. I felt loved. The love which came from it is just unimaginable, indescribable. And it was fun, too. It had a sense of humor, that light. You'll see. The Buddha said, make of yourself a light. The renunciation that we speak of is just that letting go of the outer things that trap us, that we get caught in, so we can live from moment to moment from our hearts. A poem from Machado at the end, Antonio Machado. He writes to you, wayfarers, the only way is your footsteps, one after another. There is no other way. Wayfarer, there is no way. You make the way as you go. And as you go, you make the way, and stopping to look behind, you see the path that your feet will travel again. Wayfarer, there is no way, only foam trails in the sea. The image from the Buddha of those who understand the heart of renunciation is moving through the world like a bird moves through the sky without leaving a ripple or a trace. There's a graciousness and an ease. And it doesn't mean leaving your home or leaving your castle. It means the mind and the heart open to the sky and the wind and the beauty of life and finding that nourishment which is our true nature by being present here in this which is timeless and eternal. Let's sit for a moment. It's so important to come back to our being, to come back to our heart, before all the thoughts and plans, that place of knowing, place of freedom. Let your life be guided by what truly brings you happiness. You know what that is. By your love, your caring, your capacity for presence and awakening. That's the real gift you can offer to yourself and offer to the world.
This concludes part 3 of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Please turn the tape over for part 4.